should have one of these handouts. If you don't, I can pass them out from up here, or if you're near the back of the room, there's some in the back on the small table. I really don't intend to spend time during the lecture going over this, but I provided this, if you're interested, to look into it. Last time we talked about the fact that a number of, let's say the majority of modern biblical scholars would argue that the Pentateuch or the first five books of the Bible are not written by one person, i.e. Moses, but were collected from a series of ancient traditions brought together by a number of different editors. And these are some of the passages which are often pointed to in support of the idea that the Pentateuch is the product of a number of editors rather than a single author.
Is this what we call the Pentateuch?
Pentateuch, right. So, also last time, during the discussion, it was mentioned that a lot of the views that I was presenting were not really balanced. They were going in a certain direction, and I think you'll find that will be the case throughout the course, simply because there's not enough time to deal with the whole range of interpretations of any one passage. And generally, what I'm going to try to do is pick out certain lines of arguments which I think will be most stimulating to you, not necessarily that I think are right or wrong. So I hope that you don't necessarily believe everything that I say. What I'm trying to do is just expose you to some ideas and approaches that you might not be familiar with. Since most of us, I think, are more familiar with conservative traditions or backgrounds, I will not generally be presenting the traditional, or what we've come to think of as traditional interpretations. But I would draw your attention to two books that we have here in the Acor Library, which do present a defense of a very traditional or conservative approach. One is by K.A. Kitchen, I think it's Kenneth Kitchen, called Ancient Orient in the Old Testament. And the other one is by Keller, The Bible is History. And both of these books very strongly argue against people like Herman Winkle, saying that the book of Genesis did not contain legends, it's primarily historical writing and so forth. So I certainly don't want to deny the fact that there are all different perspectives. Before we start in, I might ask, does anybody have any questions with the readings or anything we've dealt with thus far? Any questions, problems? Okay, what I want to try to do tonight is finish off our discussion of the biblical view of prehistory, that is what the Bible says in Genesis 1 through 11, and then tomorrow night we'll start dealing with the early Bronze Age and questions of the patriarchal period, taking into account some of the recent discoveries and claims associated with places like Ebla and the like that they may or may not shed on the patriarchal period. Unfortunately, we just don't have enough time to deal with all of the stories in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and so what I thought I'd pick out and concentrate on tonight are a couple of chapters which constantly raise a lot of questions. And whenever I speak on a subject like biblical archaeology or archaeology and biblical history, inevitably there are a number of questions related to the flood and the discovery of Noah's Ark and so forth. So I thought we'd take that as kind of a case example tonight, deal with that rather thoroughly, then in a very summary fashion talk about the archaeological evidence for the prehistory in Jordan, and then conclude by talking about what possibly archaeology has to tell us or what light it has to shed on the first 11 chapters of Genesis. Okay, as you read through the first few chapters of Genesis, you'll notice that although there are a series of more or less independent stories, the creation account, the Garden of Eden, the quarrel with Cain and Abel, following then Cain's genealogy, talking about the building of the first city. One thing that you'll find is that things do develop from the time that Adam and Eve are thrown out of Canaan, or thrown out of Eden, right up to the flood. A lot of scholars would say there's a very clear anti-urban bias in the first few chapters of Genesis. And you do see that once Cain kills his brother Abel, that his descendants become then the first city dwellers. They establish the first city, then they become forgers of bronze and iron and so forth. And you do see that throughout the book of Genesis, a tendency to equate the growth of urbanization with the growth of wickedness. Even later in the Bible, you notice that the Exodus period, of the period in the wilderness when the Israelites under Moses are coming from Egypt through wilderness and then up to the Promised Land. Once they get in the Promised Land, they settle down and things start going bad again. Prophets in the Iron Age look back and talk about the great period of the wilderness when we weren't tempted by all the temptations of city life and cave. So in any case, you do see this idea that from the time of creation, things get worse and worse and worse, and then finally, that sets the stage for the flood. And there's one very interesting verse in Genesis chapter 6, we're leading up to the flood, say verses 5 and 6. And when Yahweh saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and every imagination and thoughts of his heart was only evil continually, and Yahweh was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. You remember last time we talked about the different strands of traditions, or sometimes people will talk about the different documents, the J document, the E document, P and D. Most people would say that this verse 6 of chapter 6 is obviously J. Remember, one of the characteristics we pointed out of J, which is the earliest source in the Pentateuch, is that it's very anthropomorphic in its language. It talks about God walking in the Garden of Eden, looking for Adam and Eve, saying where are you, and so forth. Whereas the P document, which is the latest after the exile, speaks of God never in anthropomorphic terms. It always views God in a very transcendent idea. As you can see from Genesis 1, if people are correct in assuming that Genesis 1 is a creation account of the P document, there, God has nothing to do with creation in terms of actually physically creating, like he does in Genesis 2, where he picks up the clay and molds man and woman. In Genesis 1, he speaks and things happen. It's an emphasis that God does not participate in the immediate affairs of mankind. Here again, makes a statement that God is sorry. Some of your translations may say God repented that he had made man. It's one of the more interesting theological verses in Genesis because it indicates that according to the J writer, God actually can make a mistake, or at least that he can do something not knowing how it's going to turn out, and then find out, my golly, it didn't turn out the way I wanted to, I've got to start all over, I've got to wipe him out and start again. You know, that's the kind of a statement that in the later period just would not be said. And I think actually it goes very much against what most people think today, whether you come from a Christian tradition or a Muslim tradition or a Jewish tradition. We have a tendency to emphasize the sovereignty of God, the omnipotence of God. God knows everything in the future. He determines everything in some way or another. And this is looked upon as being a very crude, by most people, a very crude way of speaking about God. In any case, so the flood story begins at that point, God deciding that he's got to change something. I'd like just to review the flood story very quickly and then look at it a little more critically. It's probably one of the more familiar stories of the book of Genesis. Noah is told to go out, get all of the animals, build an ark, put them in the ark, along with his family. It rains for 40 days and 40 nights. After the rain, Noah opens the window and sets out a raven first, you might remember. Then on three different occasions sets out doves. Finally, the last dove does not return, so Noah realizes that everything's dried up, it's safe to go out. He goes out, builds an altar, sacrifices a clean animal. God is happy with the sacrifice, says that he'll never destroy man again, puts a rainbow in the sky, and it's kind of a happy ending. It's interesting, the so-called covenant of Noah, which comes at the very end of the story, you might notice that there are a series of different covenants in the Old Testament, the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, so forth. The unique characteristic of the covenant with Noah is that it's the only so-called covenant that God makes in the Old Testament, not only with man, but with all of the animals. All of the animals are considered to be part of this particular covenant arrangement. Okay, like most familiar stories, we're liable to overlook some of the details, and I would like to go back and point out a few passages which indicate, again, to at least the majority of scholars, that like the creation account, the account of the flood in the Old Testament is not one story, but it's a composite. It's made up of two different stories which have been combined. And just to point out some of the verses, and you can look these up and read them later, Genesis, all of the references I'll be giving are Genesis, so I won't write that down. Genesis 7, verse 1 through 5, compared to Genesis 7, verses 6 through 9, and 13 through 16. What's interesting about those two verses, if you read here, it indicates that Noah is to go and get seven pairs of clean animals and one pair of unclean animals. And those are the animals he's supposed to take in the ark. When we read the story, we automatically tend to think of this version in which Noah is told to go out and get a male and female of both clean and unclean animals. So again, there seems to be a discrepancy here between, you know, what did Noah get? Did he get just two of each? Or did he get seven pairs of clean animal and one pair of unclean animals? Also, chapter 7, verse 4 and 12, compare that with chapters 7, verse 11. And that is, how did the flood itself happen? Was it a terrible rainstorm? That's what chapter 7, verse 4 and 12 seems to indicate, that the rains came down very hard. Verse 11 has an interesting twist. Different than that, it says that the windows of the firmament opened up and the sluice gates opened up so that the subterranean waters came in as well. And in order to understand exactly what's meant in verse 11, I think we need to look quickly at what not only the ancient Hebrew worldview was, but the worldview that they shared with most people in this part of the world. They didn't think of the world as a little round ball. It was thought of as being flat. Obviously, it's got water on the edge of it. All you have to do is go to the Mediterranean Sea, and you can tell that the earth stops and the water starts. Everybody's familiar with springs and rivers which come from underground. So it was thought that there was water underneath the earth, and so that the earth didn't just fall into the water. The earth was founded on pillars. it obviously rains from the sky, so there must be water around or overhead. And what keeps that water from coming in is the sky, which is a big vault or arch. You also see that reflected, that view, in the very first chapter of Genesis, the first creation account, verse 7, where it says, "And God made the firmament," or the arch sky, "and separated the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament." So the sky is created to keep the waters out of the earth. And it just, let me read that one verse, chapter 7, verse 11. "And on that day all the foundations of the deep burst forth," indicating that these sluice gates in the earth open up and the floods come up onto the earth, "and the windows of the heavens were opened." So in other words, you know, a little window here opens up and the water comes in. Okay, well, whether or not you buy the idea that there are two accounts, you're still left with the question, did the flood actually happen? I think it's inevitable, once archaeology came into being about 100 years ago, that people would ultimately try to use archaeology to prove either or to disprove the historicity of the flood. Back in 1654, there's a fellow by the name of Archbishop Usher who, and this is before archaeology comes into the scene, Archbishop Usher made a very careful study of the genealogies of the Old Testament. He was also very interested in trying to establish exactly when the flood took place, as well as when creation took place. And from his study of these genealogies, he came to some conclusions. I'd like to write those down because we'll be referring back to them throughout this course. Archbishop Usher, that's U-S-S-H-E-R, determined from his study of the genealogies that creation took place at 9 o'clock a.m. on October 26th, I think it's 26th, yeah, 4004 B.C. Some of your Bibles, if you have a Scofield Bible, that in fact might be written in your Bible at the top of the page, creation 4004 B.C., and so forth. Bishop Usher's chronology stood up for several hundred years and is still considered by some to be orthodox. Secondly, the flood, according to Usher, took place in 2348 B.C. Abraham was born in 1996, and the Exodus was 1491. Those are all B.C. dates. Yeah, Derek? I think that's Usher himself, but you might be right. There were a number of people that worked on this whole question. Okay, I'll have to look that up. That may well be right. Yeah, it's, I don't know all the details. Again, 9 o'clock a.m. is generally, in the ancient world, what's talked about as being the first hour. Yeah, October 26th, 9 o'clock a.m., 4004 B.C. Okay, one thing I think that you need to remember is very important to stress that this has become accepted by so many people as being the traditional date that very often you'll hear people make statements like, well, according to the Bible, creation took place in 4004 BC. Of course, there's no place in the biblical text that ever attempts to date when creation takes place. That's a traditional view since the 17th century, about 300 years ago, but again, it's just an idea. There's nothing in the biblical text to indicate that biblical authors thought that, that was the case. Yeah. I don't think so. Yeah. Oh, boy, I'm not really sure. What's that?
Lightfoot was the series.
Is that right?
Where did he actually live?
16, at least that I don't know the actual dates of his life, but 1654 is when he put forth this.
1654.
Right.
How did he deduce this date and this principle?
Okay, yeah.
Okay,
how he the question was, how did he deduce these dates? What he did was work back through the genealogies. There are several chapters of genealogies, chapter 10 of Genesis, chapter 5 of Genesis, and then scattered through the rest of the book. Even in the New Testament, you have a genealogy that traces the ancestry of Jesus back to Adam. Well, back to Abraham, I believe it is, in Matthew, and then back to Adam, according to the ministry. And again, in those genealogies, it says not only so-and-so begat so-and-so, but often tells how old they were when their son was born. So by adding up all those numbers, he worked his way back to 4,000. Yeah, he got it out of the Bible itself. Again, what he's assuming is that those genealogies are very precise. In fact, if you compare the different genealogies, in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, you come up with variations. And very often, somebody will be said to have begat somebody, and it turns out from another section of the Bible, you can see that this person was supposedly not this person's son, but it's their great-great-grandson. So, okay, so in any case, whether you go with October 26th at 9 a.m., it was accepted that the creation took place around 4004 BC and the flood around 2348, roughly until the beginning of the 20th century, or at least the mid-19th century. In the mid-19th century, you do have one archaeological find, which I would almost say is really the only significant find thus far, which does shed light on the biblical flood story. That took place in 1860, in the 1860s. I'm not sure exactly when it was. I think it was mid to late 1860s when a young fellow by the name of George Smith, who was an engraver for banknotes, had taken up studying cuneiform text more or less as a hobby. He was working in the British Museum and came across a cuneiform text which had been found in 1850 at the ancient site of Nineveh. What struck him about this text as he read through it was the fact that it was a story of a flood, and it sounded very similar to the biblical story of the flood. No, 1850 A.D. The British Museum. Yeah, he found the text, which was an old Assyrian text.
No, I thought it meant in the cuneiform itself.
No. That was when he actually first found or read the text. But yeah, the cuneiform text itself goes way back Again, by now there's been so many of them found from different dates, anywhere from about 500 BC back to Sumerian texts, which may date as early as 3000 BC. And that was what was so significant about this. We know that roughly the biblical flood account, at least Jay's version of it, would have been written no earlier than 1000 BC, probably around 950 BC. And the Akkadian version, which depends upon the Sumerian version, goes back to at least, or say, around possibly 3000 BC, certainly no later than 2400 BC. So this Mesopotamian version of the flood is at least 2,000 years older, at least 1,000, probably 2,000 years older than the biblical version of the flood.
This is
from
George Smith.
Right.
What year was it?
He found it in the 1860s. The tablet was excavated in the 1850, shipped to the British Museum, and then not read or understood until the 1860s. In fact, there's probably a lot of tablets like this scattered around the museums that still haven't been read.
But there's no guess on the age of the tablet.
Yeah, we.
That's 4,000.
I'd say it is an 8th century tablet, which goes back to an earlier version, which may be as early as 3000 BC. And of course, this started a big controversy then. Those who were predisposed to believe the historical accuracy of the biblical flood account argued, obviously, this is confirmation that the biblical flood did in fact occur, because you have now an independent source talking about the flood happening. On the other hand, those who were predisposed to disbelieve the historicity of the biblical account would argue, just a minute, the biblical account is immediately dependent upon this ancient Sumerian account, therefore it's probably not based in historical fact. In a little bit we'll talk about the question of possible dependence, but first I would like to just very briefly tell you what the story of the Epic of Gilgamesh is all about. What's interesting about this too, just a little sideline, George Smith, once he found this tablet, he found that it was incomplete, and he got sponsorship that sent him back to Nineveh, or sent him over to Nineveh, to take up where Layard had left off in 1850. And unbelievably, he did find the rest of the text that he had been reading, as well as the rest of the Gilgamesh Epic, along with a number of other ancient epics. Now, according to the story, Gilgamesh, who is a ruler, the fifth ruler of the first dynasty at Uruk, which in the Bible is known as Erech, he's a ruler of Uruk, and supposedly he's part human and part God. He meets up with a fellow by the name of Enkidu. They have a rocky beginning, they fight, and then finally they become very good friends and go all over the world having a lot of different adventures. Finally, Enkidu dies, and Gilgamesh is very upset about the death of his friend. He sits around to see if it's possible that Enkidu will revive. He mourns over him for 7 days. Finally, a maggot drops out of Enkidu's nose, and that turns Gilgamesh off. He says, well, there's no chance now that my friend is going to revive. So Gilgamesh, struck by the mortality of Enkidu and realizing that that's going to happen to him someday, strikes off in search of immortality. And he's told, he knows that the only mortal person who's ever received immortality is a fellow by the name of Utnapishtim. And Utnapishtim is the Mesopotamian equivalent to Noah. He's a fellow that was told by the gods to build an ark, get the animals together. Again, just almost exactly the same story as the biblical account as far as the way in which it happens. At the end of the flood, because of his heroism, the gods confer immortality upon the fisher. Finally, Gilgamesh finds this fellow in paradise. Rishtam relates the story of the flood in great detail. Gilgamesh is a little bit concerned afterwards because obviously he can't obtain immortality by this method unless another flood comes along, and that's not very likely. So he asks Rishtam, what are some of the other options? One option is if you can stay awake for 7 days, then maybe the gods will be impressed and will give you immortality. He sits down and falls asleep right away, and he does a number of these things. Finally, he's told that there is a certain plant of life, and if you go off in search of this plant of life, you get it and eat it, you'll become young again. He goes off, he finds the plant. On the way back, he sees a nice little pond, goes to take a dip in the pond, and while he's swimming, a snake comes up, grabs the plant, and takes off. And so Gilgamesh comes at the very end to the very discouraging conclusion that immortality is reserved only for the gods, and that man's fate ultimately is to end up with a plaster port on his skull, which we have some archaeological evidence of. So, that's the story. I would like to read just a couple excerpts from the biblical account of the flood and then from the Gilgamesh epic and let you see what you think about the similarities. Okay, first from Genesis chapter 8, verse 6 through 12. And at the end of 40 days, this is after the flood has taken place now. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window to the ark which he had made and sent forth a raven. No place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put forth his hand, and he took her and brought her into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. The dove came back to him in the evening, and lo, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. And he waited another 7 days and went forth, and sent forth the dove, and she did not return to him anymore. And it follows then that Noah takes all the animals out. In verse 20, then Noah built an ark to the Lord, or to Yahweh, and took of every clean animal and every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled the pleasing odor, and goes on saying then that he promises never to destroy mankind by such a method again. Now, you will notice differences in the Gilgamesh account, but listen for some of the similarities as well. This is Utnapishtim, the Mesopotamian Noah, talking. He says, I opened the vent, and the fresh air moved across my cheekbones. And I looked at the sea, and there was silence. The tide lay flat as a rooftop, but the whole of mankind had returned unto clay. I bowed low, I sat, and I wept. Over my cheekbones, tears kept running. When I looked out and again in all directions across the expanse of the sea, mountain ranges had emerged in 12 places, and on Mount Seir, the vessel had grounded. Mount Seir held, Mount Nasir held the vessel fast, nor allowed any movement. For a day and a second, fast Mount Seir, the Seir held the vessel, nor allowed any movement. On the seventh day, still no movement. And on the seventh day of arriving, I freed a dove and did release him. Forth went the dove, but came back to me. It was not yet a resting place, and he came returning. Then I set free a sparrow, he, and did release him. Forth went the sparrow, but came back to me. It was not yet in the resting place, and he came returning. So I set forth a raven, and did release him. Forth went the raven, and he saw again the natural flowing of the water, and he ate, and he flew about, and he crowed, and went, still living, and came not returning. So I set free to the four winds of heaven, and I poured a libation, and scattered a food offering on the heights of the mountain. And the gods smelled the sweet savor, and the gods smelled the sweet savor, and the gods gathered like flies about the priest of the offering. Again, if we had time, you could go through the entire biblical account and the entire Mesopotamian account, but I think you can see there's very close similarities. Right, that's this one here. Right.
And then the ending is very interesting, where he describes how the drug looks when he wakes up. It looks like an eye in his account, actually, in the end of the overall.
In the Mesopotamian account, yeah. Yeah. In some ways, it's much more vivid, the descriptions. Okay, just to note some of the differences, slight differences in the account. According to the Epic of Gilgamesh, the ark is 6 decks high. According to Noah's account, it's 3 decks high. The dimensions of the ark vary from the biblical account to the Epic of Gilgamesh account. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, the ark is actually a cube, whereas according to the biblical account, it's rectangular. The difference in the name of the hero, of course, Noah versus the pagan. Also, the flood, according to the Epic, lasts for 7 days. Whereas, again, the biblical account, it's difficult to tell exactly how long the flood lasts. It appears that one version indicates that the flood lasted for 40 days and 40 nights. And after 7 days, then people come out. And after a series of 7 days, the other version seems to indicate that the flood was a full year long in the biblical account. There's been a lot of discussion about dependence. Obviously, the biblical account is not as old as the Mesopotamian account, but there are so many similarities that some people have said that obviously the biblical account is directly dependent upon the Mesopotamian account. On the other hand, there are enough differences that some people have argued that there is absolutely no relationship between the two. I think the third position, which most scholars take, is the one that I would find myself agreeing with, and that is to say that the similarities are so obvious that they must have some relationship to one another. But it's quite possible that both the biblical account and the Epic of Gilgamesh are dependent upon a third, even older source, and have developed more or less independently. But again, there's enough debate that you're allowed to make up your own mind. Okay, so that's certainly the discovery of the Epic of Gilgamesh through light on our understanding of the biblical flood account, but it also threw a lot of heat. It's hard to really come to conclusions about the historicity of the flood going simply from the Epic of Gilgamesh. So, again, returning to the possibility of archaeology throwing light on the subject, the first actual claim to have discovered physical evidence of the flood came from Woolley's excavations. It was in the 1920s to, I think, 22 to 34, when Sir Leonard Woolley was working at Ur, identified in the Bible as the hometown of Abraham. As Woolley was digging down, he came to the bottom of occupation and found very silty, sand, mud, water-laid material. They continued digging and went through 10 feet of silt, 3 meters, a little less than 10 feet. And underneath this 10 feet of silt was, again, evidence of human occupation. Immediately, news spread around the world that Wally had found physical evidence for the flood. He dated it to about 2900 BC, so not all that far off from what Usher said. Although Wally himself did make some fairly reckless statements, still he was fairly careful to emphasize that this evidence of flooding that he found could not be taken as evidence for a worldwide flood, that it certainly wasn't evidence of flooding outside the Tigris-Euphrates basin. That doesn't matter, or at least it's been overlooked by a lot of people, and the floods or the silt deposits at or have been taken by a lot of people, including the folks who produced this movie recently on Noah's Ark, have been taken as evidence of a worldwide flood. At Kish, K-I-S-H, a site a little over 100 miles to the north, they also found evidence of water-laden material. Here it was only 18 inches thick and also dating from a different period. Nevertheless, that was also taken by a number of people as evidence for the flood. Presently, I don't know of anybody who would really strongly argue that what Wally found was the biblical flood. From excavations of a number of sites, it's clear that both the Tigris and especially, both the Euphrates and especially the Tigris, do flood regularly, and at times the local flooding is very severe. There's certainly no evidence that there was a gigantic flood that covered the whole Tigris-Euphrates Valley within human memory, that is, within the last 4,000 years. Right. Right. And that's where you get into all this controversy. If you take both Gilgamesh and the biblical account as saying that this was a tremendous flood on a local level, but still more or less flooding the known world at that time, or even a small part of the world, but that certainly could be the source of the stories. Right. What I'm arguing, though, again, is things like this movie on Noah's Ark, where they're using that as evidence for a worldwide flood, and nobody would really support that.
No, the days when people thought the earth was flat. Mm-hmm. Every individual thought they were the center of the earth. You know, each civilization thought they were it, until they met up with the others. So that if your whole area was more or less wiped out, that would be the whole world. Mm-hmm. Well, you wouldn't know of the existence of the other. Right.
Possibly, but there was lots of trade going on in that period as well as in earlier and later periods. That doesn't mean that they thought that the whole world was destroyed because their city was destroyed. You know, it's just something that affected them strongly that they might have.
Done. Certainly from the Neolithic time, people were aware of
at this time, the area was 400 miles, so it was quite a considerable bit. Was there a well?
Right. Well, again, Wally had used that figure that the flood extended 400 miles long up the valley and 100 miles across. Some people, like Linda, who've done more work in Iran, would probably be in a better position to judge that. But I really don't think that those initial statements of Wally have been borne out by excavations since that time. Again, there are a number of floods at sites, but they're all from different periods, too. That creates a problem. You know, you could say in that 400-mile by 100-mile wide band, there was a lot of flooding, but not one big flood that happened at the same time.
The
time
of the flood, let's assume it's 2,500, 3,000 BC. You say that the people living on the earth at that time knew of the existence of other people.
Right.
Within what sort of a radius are you talking about? I suggest to you someone living at Wadi Mujahid chief is unlikely to know about the existence of someone after the masters.
But on the
other
hand, there was plenty of trade, but in this area,
what kind of
trade? You know, in Iraq and Ur, people were trading at least India and at least to Western Turkey.
Yeah, again, this is
in 3000 BC.
Yeah,
on a very much more modern note, we've had two world wars without the entire world being involved.
Exactly.
They are called
right.
world wars.
Right. Again, yeah, what we're talking about, this is a fairly small area right in here. But certainly, from the Neolithic times, you have trade, say, from obsidian coming from Turkey all the way. And again, whether the average guy on the street in Wadi Musa 5,000 years ago really knew much about the people in Turkey, he knew that somebody was up there sending this. What's that? That's interesting.
I always wondered, yeah, far away, couldn't a biblical account be related to, for instance, to 18,000 BC or the time of the event of the Isis, where you had all the civilization, civilization of the Mediterranean coast here, which has been now flooded, but there's no evidence, but more or less it is known.
Yeah.
There was a water level difference of 50 to 80 meters.
That's...
And this has repeated itself in history. Several times, they would say. So could it be that by tradition, just this account of this big fear?
That has been used as a possible explanation, either local flooding or maybe massive flooding from the Tigris Euphrates, or at the end of the last ice age, when a lot of the water is locked up in the glacial sheets, as those melted. Before they melted, the sea level, say, down in the Persian Gulf would have been much lower, and as they melted, sea level raised. And would have been accompanied probably by rather dramatic shifts in weather patterns. It is certainly possible that forms the basis for the stories as well. One advantage of that theory is that you do have stories of the great flood, not only in Mesopotamia and in Palestine, but scattered all over the world. And the fact that sea level may have raised, again, that would certainly explain Genesis 7:11, which talks about not only where this rain's coming, but the water's coming up from the underworld as well. So, you know, that is possibly a dim memory that had some impact. Okay. One other thing I'd like to say. Recently, in the last 30 years or so, there have also been a number of claims of having actually found wood on Mount Ararat, especially in 1955 and 1969. And I won't go into it in great detail, but in the Biblical Archaeologist, December 1977, number 4, there is a little article, Wood from Mount Ararat, Noah's Ark, with a question mark. I think this is a fairly good summary of the claims and evaluation of the claims that have been made. Roughly stated, they found this wood. There are a number of explorers who have been looking for the wood or pieces of the Ark on Mount Ararat. One of the things you don't often hear about is the fact that in the Bible itself, Mount Ararat is not identified as a mountain. Ararat is referred to as a range. The Bible doesn't even speak about the particular mountain, which people feel that they have identified on the border of Turkey and Russia. In any case, they have found some wood in recent expeditions, and they've submitted them to laboratory analysis. And from that laboratory analysis, they've claimed that the wood is from 6 to 4,000 years old. In other words, from 4,000 to 2,000 BC in date. The problem with that dating is that it's not using radiocarbon dating, which there's problems with C14 dating, but still it's about the most reliable means of dating organic material we have. The dating that they've the way in which they've arrived at those dates of 4,000 to 2,000 BC is submitting it to different laboratories who test the density of the wood, the amount of change in color that has occurred, and also the degree of fossilization that's occurred. And on that basis, and that basis alone, is what they've come up with the dates. When they submitted samples of the same wood for C14 dating, all of the dates came out between 740 AD to 790 AD. And again, the people who are strongly defending the authenticity of these wood, this would point to the problems in C14 dating, which there are. But those are pretty consistent C14 dates. 740 AD to 790.
Where is Mount Ararat? Eastern Turkey?
Yes. Again, see, that's a problem. That's, we say, it's, it should be up around here. Yeah, right here, they've got it. But that's where you've got to be careful. When they say, you know, this is Mount Ararat, that's what people are talking about Ararat today, but we have no evidence from the Bible that that was considered Mount Ararat. What's that?
Where's the
guy? That's a little hard to say. Although it's well, no, it wouldn't be that far north. Again, the biblical description of the Garden of Eden would seem to indicate that it's down somewhere near the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates, just as it is in the Epic of Job, which again, both the Bible and the Epic are relying on similar traditions. One other thing I should say about these claims to have found wood on Mount Ararat is the fact that we have literary evidence that demonstrates that an awful lot of wood has been carried up this particular mountain that's identified as Ararat. Early explorers talk about seeing old abandoned shacks up at fairly high levels. There are 19th century explorers who carried crosses up and put them at different levels on the mountain. There was also a medieval monastery that was built on the side of the mountain. So there, in fact, if you find wood that might be 1,000 years old on the mountain, is really not all that surprising. Might also say that even a 19th century explorer could carry up, if he has a cross, if it's of a very old oak tree, and most of the wood that's been found is oak. The C14 dating is not going to tell you how long ago the tree died, not how long it's been on the mountain. So you could have an old oak tree, wood of which is carved into a cross and carried up in the 18th century, and still. Okay, finally, again, I don't know of any serious archaeologist that would take the dating of the wood that they found seriously, or at least the old dating of it. That is another problem when you get into the discussion of things like Noah's Ark. They've never had a competent archaeologist working on their expeditions. In fact, archaeologists are embarrassed by the whole thing, and you know, I've never talked in a lecture about Noah's Ark before, and it's very difficult to find a scholarly criticism of the whole search for the Ark, basically because scholars don't want to be identified or associated with the people who are looking for the Ark. There's an awful lot of hustling going on in some of these expeditions. And I'd be very careful if I was approached by somebody who said, we're looking for the Ark, either with the Ark of the Covenant or Noah's Ark, directed to shell out $20,000.
Yes.
In any case, one final thing. When it comes to archaeological evidence, if you go with Usher's date of 2348, just considering the evidence that you have here in Jordan for a universal flood, 2348 is near the end of the Early Bronze III period. It's a period of urbanization when cities are flourishing throughout Jordan and throughout Mesopotamia. It's just absolutely no evidence that city life is disrupted at this time by means of a flood. Actually, a little bit later, a lot of early dawn cities in this area are destroyed, but it appears certainly not as a result of flooding. Some people, like this fellow Keller, will put the flood back to 4000 BC. There again, then you're back into the Chalcolithic period, and again, you have no evidence that civilization here in Jordan was wiped out at that point. I'm going to give a quick 5-minute summary of prehistory in Jordan, what took Gary Ronaldson 8 lectures in 4 weeks to do in 5 minutes. Since a lot of you have had Gary's lecture, that's one of the reasons that I don't feel that it's necessary to go in too much detail into the prehistory, especially since it's earlier in the biblical period. Also, I don't know that much about the prehistory. The earliest sites, and correct me, Gary, if I'm wrong, I think the earliest site that we know definitely in this area is Ubadiah, just south of Lake Tiberias, on the west side of the Jordan River. It has remained stone tools and also animal remains, some extinct animals, or at least animals who are not found in the area anymore. Dates back to what, 600,000? Okay, we'll do it in 690. BC or BCE? Okay. You know the distinction there, BC before Christ to BCE before the Common Era. In any case, in Jordan itself, we have a number of sites from the Paleolithic period, although studies in prehistory in Jordan are really in their infancy. Until people like Gary and Linda Villiers and a few other prehistorians showed up a few years ago, very little was known about the prehistory of Jordan. The site of Ain el-Esed, where Gary has been working on at Osrock, has been known for a long time. That is a lower Paleolithic site, older than 75,000, maybe most of it about 125,000 BCE, or 125,000 years ago. There are also lower Paleolithic sites at Jaffer and Kilwa. Recently, Gary has discovered what's probably the largest lower Paleolithic site in Jordan, or at least the largest one known so far. How do you say it? Fajaji? Down near Shobak. And he's also come up with some sites not far from Qurana, which may date back to 500,000 BC. Certainly, as more and more surveys are done in Jordan, the number of Paleolithic sites are clearly going to skyrocket. Linda's come across a number of them also down in Paula. Probably the best known Paleolithic site, which comes at the end of the Paleolithic period, either Upper Paleolithic or Epipaleolithic, depending on who you listen to, is a Qurana Flint site, which dates to roughly 17,000 to what, 12,000 BC, roughly. Just this year, there was an important discovery of a human burial, which may be as old as 17,000 BC. We're quite sure that the people during the Paleolithic period in Jordan were hunters and gatherers, that is, they were collecting wild plants to live on and following the wild herds. So although they may stop and settle in a place for a small period of time, a short period of time, they would have a tendency then to move on. At the end of the Old Stone Age, you come into another period known as the Neolithic or the New Stone Age, which is probably the most important period. That's always the most important, but it seems to me it is one of the most important periods in the development of mankind. During the Neolithic period, you'll often hear about the Neolithic Revolution, which hasn't anything to do with military action. It's an agricultural revolution. It's during the Neolithic period that people for the first time began to domesticate plants and animals and as a result begin to settle and stay in one place the year round, developing all kinds of specializations as well that come along with, I say, urban life. With southern life. Up until a few months ago, Beda was probably the most well-known early Neolithic site in Jordan, although there's also a fairly well-known site up near Jericho, Abu Suwan. I think most people at Acor at least would agree that the recently discovered pre-pottery Neolithic B site of Ain Ghazal on the east edge of the mountain will probably become as well-known, if not more well-known, than Beda within the next few years. Besides the Neolithic or the agricultural revolution that took place during the Neolithic period right around 6000 BC, pottery was invented. And from that point on, pottery becomes the most abundant artifact at ancient sites, or at least in most cases. Another thing that happens, it's very important here in Jordan, right around 6000 BC, which is the division between the early Neolithic and the late Neolithic, is that in previous or earlier times, people were inhabiting the desert probably just as densely as they were inhabiting the hill country here in the Jordan Valley. Right around 6000 BC, there seems to be fairly dramatic climatic changes. People move out of the desert, except a few folks like the Umayyads who come more later and go across the Caucasus. But towards the end of the Neolithic, the late Neolithic, you do find the desert being abandoned and most of the settlement heading in towards the Jordan Valley. As far as I know, Al Leonard might be able to correct me on this, there's one late Neolithic site down near Baba Draw to the east of Baba Draw, which has produced early pottery. I'm not sure that there's any other late Neolithic sites in Jordan that have pottery. Is that? Okay. Yeah. Out of time, though. Let me just make one more comment about when you move from the Neolithic then into the Chalcolithic period, roughly from 4300 BC to say 3200 BC, you'll find that again the Jordan Valley during the Chalcolithic period seems to be where most of the settlement takes place, although you do find some exceptions like Sahah. Chalcolithic settlements are characterized by being unfortified near a nice stream of fresh water. All of the pottery is still handmade. They haven't invented the wheel yet. The wear of the pottery is very coarse. Some typical forms are, which are restricted to the Chalcolithic period, are these coronets, very elongated base type or cup type things. Churns, what are known as churns. Al was just talking about one very distinctive form that's called the shaving mug. Comes from Chalcolithic sites, but now he thinks that's probably just the end of the churns that people have misidentified. It's a mug, right? In any case, towards the end of the Chalcolithic period, you do find copper implements being introduced here in Jordan, and we'll talk next week about the beginning of the Bronze Age. All of this, I think, does relate, again, when you get back to the question, what's archaeology shown us about the prehistory of the Bible, the first 11 chapters of Genesis? Certainly, we can say there's just absolutely no doubt that here in Jordan, occupation goes from at least 500,000 years ago right up to the present.